This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Real life is scarier than anything we can dream of, and we dream such frightening things. Sci-fi and Scream.
Be afraid.
Be very afraid on Joy 94.9.
You are listening to Sci-fi and Scream. I'm Kaz. Sonia has got the night off. We are talking a little bit Irish this fine St. Patrick's Day. We're going to have a little bit of a look at the Irish influence on sci-fi and horror. We're also going to hear Sonia's interview with the writer Amy MacDonald. And as usual, we're going to cover the latest news in sci-fi and horror. So I just played a little bit there of When Irish Eyes Are Smiling, in case you hadn't heard enough Irish music today. Before we get into it tonight, I actually just need to put out a quick message for someone who SMS'd or emailed into us, might have been last week. Now, in our last show, we were talking a little bit about ghosts, and we had someone who said that they had a friend who ran ghost tours in Melbourne. Unfortunately, not all of the information came through on the system, so if you are still listening and you've got the friend who runs the Melbourne ghost tours, we'd love to have a chat if you could send your details in again. I've done one of the Melbourne ghost tours before, and while I'm completely sceptical, it was good fun. It was pretty damn educational as well. It told a great story about what used to happen in old Melbourne town. For example, the Queen Vic Market used to be a cemetery. Well, it still is, really. So we learned all of that sort of stuff on the Melbourne ghost tour. Okay, so St. Patrick's Day. It started out as an entirely Christian thing, but it's pretty much wholly secularised now, a celebration of Irish culture and, let's be honest, getting completely bombed. Now, the Irish themselves have a very proud tradition of sophisticated horror stories. You've got Bram Stoker, who was the author of Dracula, and Sheridan Le Fanu. It was probably Ireland's premier author of Gothic fiction, including his works included things like Carmilla, which was one of the first vampire stories and definitely important because it involved a female vampire, and In a Glass Darkly. There was also the work of Oscar Wilde, most notably The Picture of Dorian Gray. However, the output of particularly Irish horror or science fiction product has definitely slowed in recent years. If anything, Irish legend has been appropriated by US film producers who have come up with complete shockers, like the Leprechaun series of horror films. So many bad memories if you've ever seen those films. Now, the first Leprechaun film came out in 1993. It starred a pre-Friends Jennifer Aniston and had Warwick Davis as the Leprechaun. He was in Willow and Harry Potter, but he makes a lot of his money from these kinds of films. Now, the story goes that an evil leprechaun is released from his four-leaf clover-locked prison 10 years after he was locked away. Once freed, the leprechaun goes on a terrifying rampage looking for his lucky gold coins. It's such a classic story, isn't it? Now, the film wasn't a mighty success, as you might expect, but it did well enough to spawn a whole series of movies. Now, Leprechaun 2 was the last of these to be released in cinemas. Surprise, surprise. The rest was straight to video. Now, there was Leprechaun 3, and we don't need to worry too much about the story of that, but there was also Leprechaun 4, which was set in space. Now, as if the Leprechaun stories themselves couldn't get any worse, the Leprechaun is pursuing some kind of odd, I think she's a galactic princess or something like that. Just a really, really terrible branching out. The next film after that was number 5, and wait for it, it was called Leprechaun in the Hood. Now that's THA, Hood. And not only was Warwick Davis in that, he's in all the Leprechaun movies, but he starred in that with Ice-T and Coolio. It's been a long time since I've seen Coolio in anything really, and I'm not sure that's entirely a bad thing. The last film was actually in 2003, and it was called Leprechaun, Back to the Hood. I'll just give a little bit of radio silence for all the groans that I hope are going on out there. Back to the Hood, basically, I think it went back to the same place as the original Hood Leprechaun movie. And once again, the leprechaun just wreaks havoc. It's the same old story. There's really not a lot you can do with it, but he's always, always in pursuit of his lucky gold coins. Some of the classic lines from the original Leprechaun were, "Try as they will and try as they might, who steals me gold won't live through the night." Another classic is, "Have you seen a crock of gold lying around? Tell me or I'll bite your ear off and I'll make a boot out of it." And of course the classic line from Leprechaun, you can't go past, "Burn in hell, you little green bastard." And that, of course, was U2 with Hold Me, Thrill Me, Kiss Me, Kill Me. That was from the Batman Forever soundtrack, which is my favourite Batman movie. I don't care what anybody says, Val Kilmer was awesome and Jim Carrey was hilarious. Now, you're on Sci-Fi and Squeam with Kaz. Sonia's taking a little bit of a break tonight. We are talking a couple of different things tonight. In celebration of St. Patrick's Day, we're going to talk a little bit about the Irish influence on horror and sci-fi. Later on in the show, we'll also have an interview that Sonia did with Amy McDonald, who is our local writer. Now, Amy had a successful reading at Hares and Hyenas in Fitzroy that was part of the Midsummer Festival. And Sonia's going to ask us some questions about her influences and the plot of her recent stories. Now, you are listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam. I was playing you too. We're going to play a little bit of Irish music tonight just to get you in the mood if you're not already. Hopefully you're all out there enjoying your St. Patrick's Day. I'm Kaz. This is Sci-Fi and Squeam. We'll be back after these messages. You are listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9. My name's Kaz and I'm taking you through this St. Patrick's Day evening. Now, we spoke a little bit before those messages about the horrible films that are the Leprechaun series of horror films. Now, if you've ever seen them, you'll know that it's a horrible, you know, overblown story of a leprechaun who is in pursuit of his lucky coins. Now, that's an American production of what people might call an Irish sort of myth or story about the leprechauns, which are a big part of the mythology or big part of the mythology that's made it. And there are still a few Irish horror stories making it to the big screen. Now, they generally tend to be set in rural areas, but it seems that more and more of them are moving into the realm of the urban ghost story or thriller. And I wait with bated breath to see what can come out because I think there's a real wealth in Irish mythology, in Irish sort of history, and in what's happening in Ireland, both in urban areas and rural areas today. So I'd love to see more come out of that. And I think if Irish science fiction, horror or fantasy matched the literary or the literary fiction tradition, it would absolutely blow our minds. So damn the Irish for being so highbrow and cultured. Now, there was a film that came out in 2004. It was called Dead Meat. It was a zombie film. Now, I actually haven't seen that one, but I've heard fairly good things about it. From what I can tell from reviews, it's a pretty straightforward George Romero-style zombie flick. The other film that I wanted to look at was called Isolation. It's directed by Billy O'Brien. Now, the basic plot of the story is there's a farmer, he's on his farm. He's it's the birthing season, I suppose that's what you'd call it. I'm a city person, I have no idea. He's trying to deal with pregnant cows who are about to give birth to their calves, and he's generally feeling very much under the pump. Now, this farmer's calves are born pregnant with sort of these weird little inside out freak fetus things attached to them. Which after they try to perform an autopsy on these little calves, and these bizarre fetus things get loose and they start growing into these horrible, horrible monsters. Now, it sounds weird, and it is, but it's quite funny. And the film really offers kind of a long atmospheric build up. And in the last half hour, you just kind of get one of those sort of high quality, monster runabouts. with these really kind of well-realized creatures darting out of the shadows and inflicting horrible damage on the rest of the humans in the cast. Now, it's not a huge tradition, Irish horror or Irish sci-fi films, Irish sci-fi less so, tends to sort of fit into the broader British science fiction or horror genres. But the Irish are sort of getting there. Now, as I mentioned, there's a lot of Irish-American co-productions. Now, Karen Marie Moaning is an American author who has set her Fever series in Dublin. It deals with a woman who is born into the kind of a race of seers or supernatural warriors who must fight for humanity in these wars between sort of the good fairies and the bad fairies, I suppose you could break it down to. It's basically an urban fantasy series, and it's actually done so well that the rights to the stories have been optioned by 20th Century Fox. So even though it would be an American production, Dublin could be on the big screen. That's a reality. Crawling with dark shades and demons, these creatures that appear in the books. Now, as I mentioned, Ireland has a strong literary tradition, and one of my favourite poets is actually W.B. Yeats, and he wrote a poem about a man called Roger Casement, and he called it The Ghost of Roger Casement. Now, I understand there's already been a film or a documentary made about the life of Roger Casement, which takes a far more obviously sort of historical perspective, but W.B. Yeats actually knew Casement, who was an Irish revolutionary executed for treason in 1916. He was a nationalist and a humanitarian. Casement was also same-sex attracted, and that was something that his enemies tried to use against him during his trial. So I thought I'd just read you the poem written about Roger Casement by W.B. Yeats. The Ghost of Roger Casement. Oh, what has made that sudden noise? What on the threshold stands? It never crossed the sea because John Bull and the sea are friends. But this is not the old sea, nor this the old seashore. What gave that roar of mockery, that roar in the sea's roar? The ghost of Roger Casement is beating on the door. John Bull has stood for Parliament. A dog must have his day. The country thinks no end of him, for he knows how to say, at a beanfest or a banquet, that all must hang their trust upon the British Empire, upon the Church of Christ. The ghost of Roger Casement is beating on the door. John Bull has gone to India, and all must pay him heed, for histories are there to prove that none of another breed has had a like inheritance or sucked a such milk as he, and there's no luck about a house if it lacks honesty. The ghost of Roger Casement is beating on the door. I poked about a village church and found his family tomb, and copied out what I could read in that religious gloom. Found many a famous man there, but fame and virtue rot. Draw round, beloved and bitter men, draw round and raise a shout. The ghost of Roger Casement is beating on the door. You're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9. My name's Kaz. I usually have Sonia sitting across the desk from me, but Sonia is doing some very important work tonight for MQFF, Melbourne Queer Film Festival. So she's taking a little bit of a break for that. Now, we just played a couple of tracks from some Irish performers. We had The Blower's Daughter. That is Damien Rice's track, and you might remember it from Closer, which was a film that came out a few years ago with Clive Owen, Jude Law, Julia Roberts, and Natalie Portman. And the other track we heard was Whatever Gets You True by Patty Casey, and that's one of my favourite tracks. And as is customary on Sci-Fi and Squeam, we've got a little bit of news for you. Now, Summit, the production company that has struck gold with the Twilight series, is set to move from vampires to Wiccans. According to Deadline New York, Summit has snapped up a script called The Last Witch Hunter by Corey Goodman, who has also written two other films currently in production, Priest, which is going to star Paul Bettany, and the remake of The Brood, which admittedly is not one I've seen. Now, the article goes on to say that Night Watch director Timur Bekmambetov is in talks to produce and possibly direct the film. The script apparently has franchise potential, and what doesn't these days, and is about one of the last remaining witch hunters who is on a mission to keep the population of witches and warlocks in check. Cerian McKellen has let slip on his website that he'll be in New Zealand in June to start shooting on The Hobbit. He will, of course, be reprising his role as Gandalf the Grey. Now, McKellen is currently performing in Waiting for Godot at London's Royal Theatre, or Theatre Royal, I should say, in Haymarket. And Guillermo del Toro will be directing the epic production of The Hobbit, which is set to be released in two parts. The shooting schedule is rumoured to be around 370 days, which is absolutely mind-boggling to have someone on set for 370 days. The original Lord of the Rings three films were filmed sort of in tandem in a very similar way, but The Hobbit, I can only imagine they're really kind of breaking that story down and are going to have a lot of detail in it, which is going to be something to look forward to. The original sets, like Hobbiton, are going to be restored to their former glory for the shoot. Horror of horrors, in a Twitter just yesterday, the 16th of March, the Zombie Diaries co-director Michael Bartlett announced information about a sequel to the 2006 independent zombie film. Now, the tweet says, "Just waiting for Harvey and Bob Weinstein to approve the paperwork, and we're fully financed and ready to go." Now, Hollywood's Magic Weinstein producers apparently have approved a US-made deal. Now, this film was a UK sleeper. We did mention it on the show a few weeks ago, I think. It was handheld camera made. It's from 2006, and it looks like it's set to be a big money spinner for the Weinstein Company, but we'll keep you posted on any developments in that field. And that news has come to us fresh from bloodydisgusting.com. Now, Lionsgate has set a date for the release of The Last Exorcism, an exorcist tale that will be produced by the Hostel franchise king, Eli Roth, obviously, and directed by Daniel Stamm. And it stars Patrick Fabian as Reverend Cotton Marcus, a crackpot fraud of an exorcist. Are there any that aren't frauds? Who, after all his rip-offs, finally finds himself face-to-face with the real thing, perhaps. When a desperate father of, yes, you guessed it, it's a teenage girl. Why is it never a teenage boy? Who does a lot of weird yoga of the possessed kind. Could this be the work of the devil himself? We'll have to wait until after August this year to find out. Again, a lovely bit of news from Bloody Disgusting Online. And the nominees are... Nominees, that is, for directing the last of the Twilight Saga installments, Breaking Dawn. Now, there have been plenty of producers' names thrown out there and directors' names thrown out for this prestigious position. And some of the candidates are, and embrace yourselves, Gus Van Sant, Sofia Coppola, Lars von Trier. Now, Lars von Trier directed some really interesting films. He directed Dogma, which if you've seen, I'll be buggered if I can figure out how they're going to translate his style to the Twilight films. But if you've read the last Twilight book, then you'll understand there are some pretty gross and nasty bits in it anyway. And the last director who was on the list was Bill Condon of Dreamgirls fame. That's pretty bizarro. That's all I can say about that. And Bollywood is investing in horror tales for the silver screen. Yes, it's called Sharpit, and it's an Indian version of the story of being cursed. So in this case, intergenerational curses. It's due for release at the end of this month in India, and hopefully it will make it here soon as well. It sounds pretty awesome. Now, the story goes a bit like this. A girl is trapped by a curse in her family tree, which doesn't allow her to love or marry who she wants. But her true love will have to battle to fight this curse and free her from it. And, of course, it will all be done with sexy Bollywood dance moves and music. It's going to star Amitabh Bachchan, John Abraham, Bipasha Basu and Supriya Pilgonkar. Sharpit will be directed by Vikram Bhat. Now, Deadline.com reports that apparently the rumours are not true after all, that Akiva Goldsman, who gave us Batman and Robin, will not direct Paranormal Activity 2, has been reported recently, but he's joined the team who will be responsible for fleshing out the story as executive producer, along with the first paranormal director, Oren Peli. Jason Blum and Stephen Schneider will also be involved. Now, Lionsgate Pictures have removed Kevin Gruitt, director of Saw 6, and it looks like at this stage the director's chair is still empty for Paranormal 2. So Lionsgate and Twisted Pictures hope to release Paranormal Activity 2 in October of this year. I guess we will believe it when we see it. Or see it when we believe it, however that works, if you've seen the first Paranormal Activity film. Now, you are listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam. We're going through the sci-fi and horror news of the week, and there is a fair bit of it this week. On TV, US TV network Sci-Fi has told the Hollywood Reporter that it is in early talks about a second spin-off from Battlestar Galactica, one that would return the franchise to its space opera roots. Now, this would be big news. The network kind of, you know, denies that this would affect the first Battlestar spin-off, which was Caprica. "We're looking for other ways to spin off Battlestar beyond Caprica," says Sci-Fi's executive vice president of development, Mark Stern. "That world is so rich. We're sitting down with Ron Moore, who created and produced Battlestar Galactica, and his team. It would not necessarily be a traditional series." I don't really know what that means, to be honest. Sounds like a lot of producer babble talk. Now, Caprica has been pulling in about 1.6 million viewers per episode, which is not too bad, but it's not great. So who knows if that's going to survive the chop. But there's good news for fans of the TV series Fringe. Fox has put it on hiatus about every fortnight. So if you're one of those people who likes to be able to sit down and watch a sci-fi series from week to week, Fox has been pulling the plug on Fringe every second week. However, the series has bagged itself a third season, which is really good news, and it's a really good show, so I can imagine there's lots of fans happy about that one. In other news, it appears that there will be a way to keep us awake this year, with a new online game announced to tie in for the release of the remake of Nightmare on Elm Street. Now, it's the game where you play for her life. I'm not sure what her they're referring to. And how can you stop the heroine from having a fatal nap? Now, obviously, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street, if you fall asleep, you know, you need to get out of that dream. And there's a very funny Simpsons episode on that as well. Now, the fun-sounding game is all part of the marketing hype that's soon to flood us from New Line Cinema and Warner Brothers as a lead-up to Freddy's return to the big screen. I think I'm just going to stick to English breakfast tea myself to keep myself awake. An influential SFX magazine has published the results of a reader's poll. Now, they're looking for the number one sci-fi book, and that can obviously include fantasy. And as you would expect, there are loads of Terry Pratchett books in there. Number three was Dune by Frank Herbert. Number two was The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams. And number one was, not surprisingly, The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien. Now, that was our sci-fi news and horror news for the week. You're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam. I'm Kaz. I'm flying solo tonight. Sonia is doing stuff for MQFF, and I wish her all the best. I hope she's having a good time. We're going to have Sonia's interview with Amy McDonald after these messages.
Now, what was it that inspired you to write a ghost story, apart from being invited on to, you know, to do this for the Midsummer? Was there any other reason?
I think, by and large, my fiction is kind of true to life, and I wouldn't say that it sort of fits into a popular fiction genre, really, with the exception of one short story that has a bit more of a science fiction bent. And so I guess I wanted to explore that more and really play with those sorts of formats or genres. So, yeah, it was just a great opportunity to try something different, and by chucking my hat in the ring, it sort of compelled me to produce, which was...
Yeah, so you haven't written any other spooky stories prior to this?
Not spooky ones, no.
Okay. No. Although it isn't actually horrific as such, or really frightening in its tone, I actually personally found it to be quite unnerving and quite scary in a way.
And someone else said it was a bit goosebumpy, and yet...
Yeah.
It's not horror.
Didn't make you jump out of your seat or wherever you were. But I think it was the mystery of that character, Anna, in the story. And I wondered if the story, Guesthouse, was based on anything or any incident that you might have experienced or picked up on?
Well, I suppose the setting, it's very loosely based on where my dad lives, and their sort of village, you know, very similar to the village that I describe in the piece. Uh-huh. And definitely the lake that I talk about is part of where my dad lives. But the two characters are just, I just channeled them from wherever creativity springs.
Exactly.
They're not based on anything necessarily.
And that brings us to one of the questions that I think some of our listeners would like to know, because we do have quite a varied listenership, and that is, of course, do you believe there are such things as ghosts?
I don't know, and I think probably, really put on the spot, okay, I think there's probably different classifications of them, and probably
yes.
Some exist, and some definitely exist for some people. For me, I'm not sure. I guess I've had some spooky things happen, and I've seen some things.
More unexplainable, probably?
I think I like knowing that element is possible and it might happen, but that I don't need to think about it too much.
A rational way of, you know, you've got to rationalise the unexplainable, I figure. Like, if there's no proof that it happened or existed, but you yourself can't come to any definite solution, I guess, then you...
It's not rationalising it, it's just accepting that it's unknown.
Fair enough.
Trying to rationalise it at all. But there are things other than what is immediately apparent, probably.
Yeah. Do you think you have to believe in ghosts to understand a ghost story?
No.
No.
No, no.
It's a definite no.
Well, you don't have to know about robbing banks to like a good, you know, espionage or thriller or something.
That's true.
I think having some familiarity with the flow of stories like that actually
that
is really
genre.
Enticing. It's what you have some kind of connection with it. You anticipate what might be coming, and that's part of the joy.
You want that sort of excitement.
It's very
and
satisfying
surprise.
When you get
and
it.
Surprise. Now, in Guest House, it has quite a lot of detail, and it's a short story. And looking at the cultural aspects of the people who inhabit the story in the locality, obviously it's Thailand. Why did you set it there?
It's just one place where I've spent a lot of time, and the people there, ghosts are a very, very important part of everyday life, much more so than they are here. Spirituality is much more pronounced there. It's commonly accepted that there are ghosts and that part of, you know, what happened. The ceremony that I described in the story, I've been to one of those where that rite of passage to be a ghost seeker has happened, and I've watched elderly women channel spirits. So this really lent itself to a great environment for talking about ghosts. And so bringing in the Western women into that setting, I thought would be an interesting contrast.
An interesting little part of that actual story is, why is it that you refer to the Australian as the Australian?
Well, my experience is that there are lots of... Well, they needed an entry point, and he is a great point of comparison. He is the gatekeeper between that sort of unknown Thai reality and what the traveller, what the main protagonist brings. So it's good for her. And, you know, he's a segue to the love interest, so he's quite important like that. And it also, I think it's kind of nice playing with clichés a little bit, like throwing out a cliché and then giving it enough substance so that it almost stops being a cliché. And older men with younger Thai wives is really common over there, living out in the country. So giving the reader that stereotype and then saying, oh, but hang on, don't settle for that just yet, because there's also these other
elements. There's a twist,
elements.
Pretty much. Also, it is actually, I think, a very sexy story, yet there isn't a heap of erotica content in it, actually, but it still has that intensity, and it feels like almost like a little secret that the character Megan has, but doesn't want to share it with anyone else. Why did you portray the character of Megan like that, in that way?
Well, it needs a level of secrecy to work for the reveal at the end.
Yep.
But I also think when you're travelling like that, especially you're a woman alone travelling, you do tend to, in some ways, you do tend to draw in a bit more, to be a bit more protective and keep more things to yourself. As at the same time, you also expand and engage with things that you wouldn't otherwise. So I know for me, when I'm travelling, my behaviour changes a lot. You don't have your friends around you to share everything with. You do get more self-sufficient with things like romance or discovery. And I think that's interesting. But at the same time, you're also opening up to new experiences in the sort of more physical sense of going new places, meeting new people.
Well, definitely that character does that.
She does.
And
she
she's
does.
Certainly not she's certainly not aware of it at first, of what it actually means, but she seems pretty open to anything. It's also quite funny.
Yeah. Because I think you do have that when you're travelling, you can sort of throw caution to the wind, and it's quite delicious to do that. You know what, I could be anybody at this point in time. I've got no reference to who I am back home. I'm just going to live for right now.
I think go with
that's
it.
That's exciting, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
I'd just like to say, too, that, I mean, you wrote this really well, I think, even though you claim not to be into this ghost sort of genre, as you've actually said to me earlier, that you felt you definitely weren't a horror fiction writer. So what was it that compelled you to write something like this?
The challenge really intrigued me, and I, like I said before, I just wanted to play with that sort of writing, genre writing, and also I think there's something interesting in a format and yet giving something that's completely different. So, you know, and I think a lot of the writers that read at that event did that. They, like vampire stories that were read or the werewolf story that was read, had those sort of traditional themes and yet they were in a really modern, interesting context. That makes for good reading.
I think so too. Now, do you think you'll be doing more ghost stories in the future?
I don't know if I would set out to do it. Oh, look, I don't know. I think there's definitely there's a big readership for that sort of work.
Yeah, it's massive, as I've discovered.
I think the way that I write is the idea just comes and sort of grows, and so I don't know if I... It's rare that I would set out with an idea in mind to construct a story around it. It's more likely that this seed would sort of pop into my brain and it would filter out through my fingers and become something. So I don't think I'm as planned as that.
No.
But having said that, now that I've tried something and it came really naturally and I enjoyed
and it
the
works.
Process. I would, who knows, maybe.
Like people do Harlequin or Mills and Boone, I mean.
Yeah.
This could be something that could be sustainable. Speaking of which, one of your other stories, speaking of sustainability, in particular the work credits, which I read online on your site, now that would fall under... to our audience of Sci-Fi and Squeam, a science fiction story. Now, what influenced you to write something like that?
Actually, it came out of a conversation that I had with somebody, but I suppose there's a few different things. Part of it is about, it's sort of a bit of an Armageddon story, in a sense.
Yes.
So let's just normalise the queer thing and talk about this with queer characters. I think that's something that drives me. But I also have been for... such a long time now, a big climate change, in my own way, a climate change activist. And before I embarked on writing, my approach to that was working in the environment movement. And I think I just got a bit stagnant and my passion began to fade. And so I thought, well, I need a different method to get the message out there, and perhaps it's through fiction. So that was a bit of an exploration in how can I convey a message about the importance of global warming in a way that is digestible to people that aren't going to, you know, go to the talks that I run or read the newsletters that I write. Yeah.
So it's definitely got that dystopic flavour about it. You know, you were saying apocalyptic, I think, or Armageddon-ish.
Yeah, well, and it's all about it's all about energy. That whole story is about energy, in the sense of turning on light bulbs and carbon credits, then energy in the sense of their relationship and how they're limited or stymied in how they can engage those two women with each other because of the imposed barriers because of climate change,
And, the whole climate change thing. I mean, in the early 90s, we saw it on the front cover of Time magazine and, you know, the whole spiel was, we can do it, we can change everything. You know, we can save the Great Barrier Reef. We can stop Siberia turning into mush. You know, we can...
I think it comes in ebbs and flows. I think... I mean, I was 12 when I wrote my first environment poster and went on my first rally. And that... It's burnout is just a real issue with people that do any type of advocacy. And I go through fits and starts myself with despair and enthusiasm. But I think probably, I don't know, I get the sense that perhaps we're all a little bit self-absorbed at the moment, really, and big houses and big TVs and staying at home and not talking to anybody. And maybe, I don't know, I think we might have all lost the plot a bit.
And I guess that brings us back to our show, like the show that I have with my co-presenter, Caroline, or Kaz. And that is, you know, why are we focusing on science fiction and horror? But it certainly, for me, is like a groundswell of something that is showing its, rearing its ugly head. And in a way, it seems to mask this incredible dissatisfaction that I think a lot of people have. And it comes out in this, you know, quite bizarre, at times horrific, incredibly violent way. But it's also almost like a mantra where you don't actually need to worry about that. It's actually a healthy expression. And it's definitely a growing area in the last decade.
I really think one of the major attractions for me to writing any type of genre fiction is that you can be so much more political, that you can actually drive all sorts of agendas. Whereas if you wrote just a piece of literary fiction, you know, everyday life fiction, and were that politically charged, people would, it would just, you know, read like propaganda and people wouldn't be interested. I think
no, it wouldn't
you
be
can
around,
really
but...
push lots of different agendas with in those sorts of formats, like horror or you know, spooky stories or whatever. I think that's one of the freedoms of writing like that. It really allows you to be more persistent.
Yeah, and we recently interviewed Mary Borsellino, who was actually at the Hares and Hyenas, and she's done 3 books already through an online website of hers called The Wolf House, and she's writing about her friends.
And it's wonderful. Her stuff is wonderful.
It's amazing. I think it's just queuing up that whole feeling that is out there, and in particular with young people, and this is how they need to express themselves, which is brilliant, I feel. Now, before I let you go tonight, I just had to ask if you have any favourite authors, if any of them might be sci-fi or horror authors.
Oh, gosh.
that's too hard, I know.
No, I think just in general, I'm terrible at favourite things.
Anything that pops into your head, anyone...
Oh, I'm going to have to let you down. I just can't think of anything.
That's okay. Well, we'll have to definitely have you back on the show. So you've got definitely have got a challenge there. And I'm so sorry to torture you like that. okay. So, look, it's been a real pleasure talking to you tonight, Amy. Hopefully we can have you in the studio for real at some stage and chat more about where your writing is leading and that sort of thing. And also, what's your website address if people want to look you up and look at the many different things that you actually do, apart from your writing, of course?
It's amymcdonald.com.au.
Excellent. And you've also got a zine, is that right?
Yes, which is called In My Own Room, and you can get it at Polyester and Sticky.
Oh, where's Spicky? Sorry, I don't know that one.
So it's at Flinders Street Station. Okay. The underpass there.
Oh, that's great down there. Yeah. Yes. Cool. All right, look, thank you so much for coming on to Sci-Fi and Squeam tonight, Amy. I've really enjoyed that. We've had our little technical moments, but we've survived. I think. The proof will be in the pudding. Now, you've been listening to Sonia interviewing and chatting to author Amy McDonald. We're just going to go to a little break now, and we'll be back soon on Sci-Fi and Squeam, only on Joy 94.9.
You are back on Sci-Fi and Squeam. I'm Kaz. That was Westlife with World of Our Own. Yeah, people, I got it on the radio. Before that, you were listening to Sonia speak to Amy McDonald, who is a Victorian writer, and she has two of her stories that are sci-fi and horror-based. One is a ghost story set in Thailand, the other a rather dystopic vision of the future. You've been listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam. Thank you very much for joining me on St. Patrick's Day. I hope you've had an interesting evening, and I hope you're not too hungover tomorrow. Thanks for joining.
Sci-Fi and Squeam was synthesised and squashed into shape by Sonia, Albert and Kaz. For more information, visit our Facebook page, Sci-Fi and Squeam, or check out joy.org.au.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.